I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. One of the issues that's gotten a lot of play this campaign season is trade and trade agreements. And it's something that has resonated with voters on all sides of the political aisle. Here's Donald Trump back in November at a GOP debate talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP.
The TPP is a horrible deal. It is a deal that is going to lead to nothing but trouble. It's a deal that was designed for China to come in, as they always do, through the back door and totally take advantage of everyone. It's 5,600 pages long, so complex that nobody's read it. It's like Obamacare. Nobody ever read it. They passed it. Nobody read it. Had to look at the mess we have right now, and it will be repealed. But this is one of the worst trade deals, and I would, yes, rather not have it. With all of these countries and all of the bad ones getting advantage and taking advantage of what the good ones would normally get, I'd rather make individual deals with individual countries. We will do much better. We lose a fortune on trade. The United States loses with everybody.
Bernie Sanders opposes NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership that was negotiated by the Obama administration. Here he is at a Democratic debate in March.
In 1960, Detroit, Michigan was one of the wealthiest cities in America. Flint, Michigan was a prosperous city. But then what happened is corporate America said, why do I want to pay somebody in Michigan a living wage when I could pay slave wages in Mexico or China? We're going to shut down. We're going to move abroad. We're going to bring those products back into this country. Those trade policies, as much as any other set of policies, has resulted in the shrinking of the American middle class. And I'll tell you what else it did. It's not only job loss by the millions. It is the race to the bottom, so that new jobs in manufacturing, in some cases today, pay 50% less than they did 20 years ago. How stupid is that trade policy?
Today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times, the pros and cons of FTAs, that's free trade agreements, the winners and the losers. Joining us by telephone is Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and chief and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. And Jared Bernstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Also with us, in fact, here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Ann Harrison. She's the William H. Worster Professor of Multinational Management and Professor of Business Economics and Public Policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research and a member of the United Nations Committee for Development Policy. And Ann Harrison, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Jared, let me begin with you. But one of the reasons we're doing this show is that trade has gotten so much play this campaign season. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that in the midst of what I think you could call a more populist election than we've seen in recent times, that is, there's a real sense of anger by lots of people who feel the economy's left them behind, many of whom have good reason to feel that way. The issue of trade as a double-edged sword has really surfaced. Now, unfortunately, in some of the quotes you hear there, politicians are often just giving us one edge of the sword, which is the downsides, the costs of trade to many of the people and their communities who've been hurt by it. Those are real costs, and too often the trade debate has brushed them aside. There are benefits as well, particularly on the consumer side, the increased supply of goods, lower prices, and so on. But the dual nature of trade is finally coming out. I actually think that's a very good thing because it's real. It's the reality that actually exists. But it does run into this demagogic problem that we just kind of heard from some of those quotes.
And we'll hear some more quotes in the hour. Ann Harrison, to you, do you think having politicians talk about trade is helpful to the voting public?
Well, the advantage of talking about trade is that politicians can zero in on something outside of the United States that they can blame for the very real challenges that we face in our economy today. We see soaring inequality. We see unequal access to good education. We see workers who used to be able to have good jobs who don't necessarily have gone to college finding that their options are much more limited than they were before. And as Jared said, people are angry. And trade provides a nice scapegoat for politicians to blame.
Well, let me pick up on that. And even the Bernie Sanders quote that we played where he said, look what Flint, Michigan was like in 1960. Trade policies have basically shrunk the middle class, a race to the bottom. I'm back to you, Ann Harrison. Can we blame what's happened in Detroit, maybe even Flint and other parts of this country, on trade agreements?
Well, I think it's really important here to actually look at what the data is telling us. It's true that manufacturing jobs have shrunk as a share of our total economy. In the 1980s, one in four jobs were manufacturing jobs. Today, it's one in 10 jobs. But if you look at that decline, it started way before any of these trade agreements were passed that the politicians are zeroing in on. So in the early 80s, we started to see a secular decline in manufacturing share, and that's been going on. And there was, in fact, you don't see before and after NAFTA any rapid increase in that decline. And so it's hard for a researcher like me to attribute these changes to trade per se. I would attribute them to other factors. In particular, what's been going on in places like Flint and places like Detroit is that companies are replacing people with machines.
Automation.
Yeah.
Jared, let me give you a chance. Yeah, go ahead. Jump in.
Yeah, so I would disagree with a good chunk of that in the following sense. I very much agree that you have to make a distinction between trade agreements and trade. And in fact, I don't think you can connect dots. Here I think I'm agreeing with Ann. I don't think you can very handily connect dots between free trade agreements or so-called free trade agreements and the outcomes we're talking about, these negative outcomes for people in their and their cities. But I do think you can draw a very clear line between expanded trade and some of what's happened to cities in the Rust Belt, some of what's happened to lots of our production workers. And I think there's actually quite good research that isolates the impact of trade on the impact of, say, manufacturing jobs, the wages of production workers in those sectors. They've clearly been hurt by, for example, expanded trade with low-wage countries like China. And in fact, as many of them have gone over from the manufacturing sector to other sectors, they've increased the supply of labor in those sectors, and that's had downward pressure on wages. Josh Bivens, an economist from the Economic Policy Institute, estimates that the cost to expanded trade with low-wage countries on non-college educated workers is about $1,800 a year, and that's real money. So I don't think there's anything like a scapegoat going on here with trade itself. I do think there's a bit of a scapegoat with these so-called free trade agreements.
Well, Ann, let me go back to you and picking up on what Jared Bernstein was just saying. Would it be fair to say it if you look back at NAFTA? Of course, TPP has not been approved by Congress, so we don't know its effect yet. But would it be fair to say that if there are losers, if I can put it that way, and these would be more low-income workers, perhaps even manufacturing, but that there are winners as well. And I want you to speak to that dichotomy.
Yeah, so Jared is right. There are losers and winners. And one thing that has changed in the conversation is that people are much more honest of the fact that there are losers. Let's take trade in general. My own research shows that when imports go up by, say, 10%, then those who are in those import competing sectors, their wages are going to go down by 3%. But what we're forgetting is that for all those imports, there's also exports. For every 10% increase in exports, people working in export competing industries from the South Carolina to the Oregon coast to all over the U.S. to all our agricultural interests in the Midwest, their wages go up by the same amount, by 3%. So there are definitely winners and there are definitely losers. This research that I suspect that Jared was mentioning about the very real costs of imports from a country like China, those just focused on the import side. They didn't focus on the export side. So you're really only looking at half the picture. Now, let me...
Yeah, hold on, Jared. Let me give you just a chance to finish.
I just want to say one more thing. if there are studies suggesting real costs to trade, I would say the only evidence we have so far that there have been significant across-the-board costs are coming from when China joined the WTO. Right before China joined the WTO, it was given permanent normal trade relations status with the U.S. What that means is that every year before, we agreed that Chinese imports would be treated the same way as imports from the rest of the world. When that happened, when that was normalized, we do actually see a big fall, a precipitous decline. That's Peter Schott's work and Justin Pierce's work. But the funny thing is, China is not a partner or a proposed partner to the TPP. So the only country where we have any evidence that increased imports has actually hurt U.S. workers is a country that's not a party to the TPP. In fact, if you, the administration is suggesting that the reason the TPP was designed was, in fact, to try to contain China.
Jared, let me give you a chance to respond to
that. Yeah, yeah. A lot to chew on there. And I do want to avoid getting into, you know, my study versus your study, because that can leave a lot of people just scratching their heads. So let me start by very much agreeing with Ann's point that China is not in the TPP. And when Donald Trump talks about the TPP and China, I, for one, have no idea what he's talking about. That said, I do think there is a real danger in mischaracterizing the lay of the land here by separating out imports and exports the way Ann did, and neglecting to mention the key outcome of their combination, which is net exports, or in our case, the trade deficit. If you listen to Ann's points, which are very much well taken in terms of the benefits of export jobs and the costs of losing jobs that compete with imports, you wouldn't know that at the end of the day, the U.S. has had large, and I mean economically large, trade deficits since the mid-1970s, amounting to an average of about negative 3% of GDP over the last 15 or 20 years. So that means that, in fact, we have been buying a lot more from other countries than we've been able to sell to them. And those costs are very real. It's not the case at all, by the way. In fact, the study I cited doesn't come just out of looking at imports. It comes out of looking at net exports. That is the combination of both the fact that we sell so much less to the rest of the world than they buy for us. That's been a tremendous cost to our manufacturers. And by the way, it's not just China. We've got a very solid evidence that our trade deficit with Mexico has hurt us as well. And in fact, let me just give you one.
Well, you know what, Jared? Hold on, only because we have to take a very short break, and then I'll give you a chance to continue. Again, that's Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Also with us, Ann Harrison. She's a professor of multinational management and business economics and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about an issue that's gotten a lot of play this presidential campaign season: trade and trade agreements. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Today on the show, Ballot Talks on Radio Times, talking about the pros and cons of FTAs. These are free trade agreements. We've been talking about some of the winners and some of the losers, and we began with a clip from Donald Trump, a clip from Bernie Sanders. Here's Ted Cruz discussing his support of so-called fast-tracking. This is on an Iowa radio show, The Steve Deese Show.
I support free trade. Ronald Reagan emphatically supported free trade. When I campaigned for the Senate across the state of Texas, I campaigned in support of free trade. I told Texans, if you vote for me, I'll fight for free trade, because I believe free trade generates jobs and economic growth. I think it helps our farmers, our ranchers, our manufacturers. When we open up foreign markets, it creates economic growth.
To join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jared, we're back to you. Go ahead and finish your point.
So I was just going to say that if you look at the wage of manufacturing workers, blue-collar workers in factories, That wage doubled between the mid-40s and the 1970s. It went from $10 an hour to $20 an hour in today's dollars. And that was a period when the trade deficit as a share of GDP was about zero. We had balanced trade for the most part. Since then, that wage has held at $20 an hour. It was $20 an hour in 1979. It's $20 an hour today, you know, 30-plus years later, over a period where we've had very large trade deficits. Now, it is by no means the only thing. I'm not saying the trade deficit is, you know, as Anna suggested, economies have lots of moving parts. There's technology. There's demand for different types of workers, of course. But there's no question that our persistent large deficits in trade have hurt our manufacturing sector and their workers therein.
Do you agree with that, Anne?
Well, the real problem, I think, is why do we have a trade deficit to begin with? If you look at it, what that means is that we're buying up more goods from abroad than we're selling. So how do we make up that gap? So the way countries make up that gap, if they're lucky like we are, they borrow. So what that trade deficit is telling us is nothing about trade agreements per se. In fact, with the 20 countries we have a trade agreements with, we actually have on aggregate, if you add them all up, we have trade surpluses. What that trade deficit is telling us is that we're basically consuming more than we should be, and we're not saving enough. Now, that is not a message that voters on either side, on every political party, want to hear. They want to hear it's the other country's fault. And so that's, I believe, why the trade message is really resonating with voters on every side of the political spectrum. Having said that, I totally agree that some people are hurt and that they need to be compensated.
Jared, let me go back to you. Would it be fair to say that some of these trade agreements have resulted in cheaper prices for goods? I mean, you can buy, you know, things that a couple of years ago, I'm thinking of TV sets and phones and clothing, how cheap so much of these goods are. Is that a result of trade agreements?
It's certainly a big part. No, not trade agreements. Again, we have to be very clear in separating out the impact of trade agreements and the impact of trade and globalization. They're not the same thing. And the price advantages that you're talking about are very closely connected to expanded trade. When I said that trade was a double-edged sword, the edge that's helpful is precisely the one you just mentioned. So the increased supply of goods has definitely led to lower prices. That said, remember, the wage numbers that we've been citing, this fact that the blue-collar manufacturing wage hasn't budged in 30-plus years, is a real number adjusted for inflation. So it takes into account any cost advantages we've seen. The people who have been hurt by trade have been hurt on net, even factoring in these costs. I want to make a correct, just a factual correction to something Ann said. It's not true that we actually run a trade surplus with the countries with whom we have trade agreements. It's true if you look at manufacturing goods, including petroleum. So you have to cut the data in a particular way. But if you look at the overall exports minus imports, then you'll see that there's a trade deficit there. And again, I take Ann's point. I very much take Ann's point about the multi-causes of a trade deficit. My point is that when you're talking about export jobs versus import jobs, you can't leave out the fact that we run large trade deficits.
And let me go back to you and something that you said in reference to China. China, we do not have a trade agreement with. Is that an argument? Are you saying, and perhaps even shifting slightly to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership that was negotiated by the Obama administration, does not include China? As you said, you see it as a way to put pressure on China. Is that we're better off with trade agreements because, as to quote Donald Trump, you know, China's killing us?
So I think your question is China a party to this agreement? And the answer is no. And then I think your second question is, would forming and approving this agreement help us in our relationships with China level the playing field? I think that is certainly the hope of the Obama administration. If you read, for example, the labor provisions, which I actually went back and did last night.
You did your homework.
If you do that, what you see is that the administration is trying to persuade all the potential partners, which form almost a ring around China, to improve conditions for their labor force, to provide them with more opportunities so they won't exploit their labor, so poverty will decline. So I think the hope, of course, is that this will make everybody better off. Whether or not that's the case, nobody knows.
To you, Jared, I mean, what I hear you saying is that you're not opposed to all trade deals or trade agreements, but what would it look like that would help the people that have been hurt by some of these past agreements in this country? What would that trade deal have to include?
Well, I think it's an important question, and some of the things Anne mentioned, she now joins a rarefied club of people who've actually cracked open the thing and looked at it.
she gets an A for doing her homework today.
A lot of people debating the TPP never read the TPP. But I think if you read some of the fine print, it's a little bit less flattering than Anne made it sound. I'll give you one good example. So to its credit, and I think that the Obama negotiators had a lot to do with this, if you join the TPP, you have to your country has to allow your low-wage labor force to have a minimum wage. And that's new in a trade agreement, and it's very much in the spirit of the sort of thing Anne was just talking about. You have to have a minimum wage. However, there's nothing in the TPP that says what your minimum wage can be. So a country like Vietnam that still is a very highly managed and a communist government and economy can have a minimum wage of 1 cent per hour and be in compliance with the TPP. You can have a union that's essentially a government-led union that doesn't really have any collective bargaining power at all. So you do have to be cognizant of the nuances. So if we were going to have a trade agreement that really helped people, it would have to have different stakeholders at the table. And one of the things we looked at during the TPP negotiations was that 85% of the folks who got to meet with the negotiators here on the U.S. side were from trade lobbyists and business interests. And in fact, when it comes to pharmaceuticals, it was 100%. So one of the problems I have with these agreements is that they're not really representing the voices of all stakeholders. They tend to disproportionately represent those of the investor class. And that leads to things in a so-called free trade agreement that are actually quite protectionist, such as extending patents or making pharmaceuticals pretty expensive for countries that really can't afford that kind of protectionism.
Are you saying there should have been more union representation at the table, things like that?
Right. The union, worker voices, Doctors Without Borders should have been at the table. They ultimately ended up complaining that the TPP is much too protectionist vis-a-vis the costs of biologic drugs. And that can be a real problem for a country like Vietnam or Malaysia or some of these developing countries in the deal.
I'd be curious what you say in response to that, Anne, and then we'll get some callers. We have a lot of people that want to join the conversation. I saw that Robert Reich, that was his complaint about the TPP, is that he saw that it benefited the investor class or people who are investors and some of these more high-profile companies.
Well, I think if you look into any trade agreement in any country in the world, what the country is ultimately trying to do is release other markets to its own goods and try, to a certain extent, restrict how much of other countries' goods in sight. We're all basically what's called mercantilists. And I would say the Obama administration probably falls into that camp, too. So, Jared, you can't have it both ways. On the one hand, we want to protect our interests and promote our interests and open other countries' markets. That's really the motivation in order to be able to tap into the global market. 95% of consumers in the world are outside the U.S. So the goal is really to open up other markets. So there are some, I agree, there are some protectionist aspects to this bill, but I think that's with an eye towards protecting the U.S. And let me just say one more thing.
Sure.
I really think on this trade issue, the train has left the station. Jared would put it, I saw in another point, he put the, the toothpaste out of the tube, right? I mean, we need to embrace the opportunities that global markets give us. And what the evidence suggests is it's true. Educated workers are going to benefit, and workers who are not prepared are going to lose. So instead of blaming these trade agreements, what we should be doing is reforming our school. If you're in West Philadelphia, your access to a good school is very different than if you're in the Upper East Side of New York City or Berkeley, California. And that is fundamentally not fair. And I think that's what the voters are responding to.
Jared, do you agree with that?
I mean, I think that that's not what the voters are responding to, although I agree with a lot of what Ann just said. Obviously, the importance of education is critical and primary. However, what the voters are responding to is when somebody who's 45 or 50 or 55 years old, who's been displaced from a manufacturing job, who's lost that kind of opportunity, who's faced the sort of stagnant wage trends that I've been describing, is told, you know what you need to do? Get back to school and get an education. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So when Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders say to this person, you've been screwed by these dynamics, obviously, they have a very receptive audience. Now, let me say, I am not trying to have it both ways. In fact, as Ann suggested, I'm very much in support of globalization and expanded trade. And if I wasn't, it wouldn't matter anyway, because it's going to happen. My problem is with trade agreements. And I think the process has become pretty corrupt, not on the U.S. side. I think we're actually pretty good. But certainly from the perspective of Congress, of money in the deal, of big pharma and all that. So I think what we really need to do to go forward is figure out a way to continue to promote expanded trade, but without trade deals. And I think that can be done, and I'm happy to talk about it if we have time.
And I'm trying to squeeze our callers in, but I know Ann wants
Understood.
To say something. No, fair enough. Ann wants to add something. Go ahead.
So, Jared, I have a question for you. So we tried a multilateral approach through the World Trade Organization where all countries come to the negotiating table and try to agree on something that includes all parties. That didn't work. Mm-hmm. So they're still trying to come up with a multilateral deal. So what are you proposing if not
good
these
question.
Trade agreements?
Yeah, fair enough. Go ahead, Jared.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And by the way, I would call the TPP a multilateral deal. And I don't know if it's working or not, but certainly it's gotten pretty far. I'm proposing a situation where we continue to build on the trade liberalization of the deals that we've had so far. So we've actually had trade deals with over 20 countries. In fact, six of the countries in the TPP are countries we already have trade deals with. So if we want to negotiate further with them, I believe we have a platform to do so. The things we need to do are things we can't do in a trade agreement. So countries manipulate their currency. They manage their currency to get an unfair trade advantage, not just over us, but over other trade partners as well. We in the U.S. should act independently to do so. We should pass rules that prohibit that. Secondly, we should do...
Oh, no. Somehow.
It's a tiny little microcosm, but you're beginning to see an opening for a trade there, even in a country with whom we have a very foolish and antiquated embargo, and with no free trade agreement anywhere in sight.
We had a little blip there, Jared, but I do need to get some callers in. Let's see what
made them.
Fair enough. Let me get Mary from Lansdale to join us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My retired parents just moved to Iva, South Carolina, which is about an hour's drive south of Greenville, South Carolina. They moved there because it's cheap. Well, it's cheap because there are no jobs. And there are no jobs because it used to be a textile manufacturing area, and they were hanging on with one factory, which just left for China a few years ago. There is such inchoate anger in that area that it's a huge Trump area. And my question is, number one, do we need a manufacturing stimulus policy like they have in Germany to get folks like this back to work? And number two, doesn't this just aggravate the already big gulf between the urban and the rural areas in terms of how wealthy they are? Because if your guest has a point about exports benefiting the U.S., mm-hmm. those benefit the urban areas near the ports, and then areas like Iva, South Carolina, languish.
Well, and you've raised a couple of really good points. And let me go back to you and something Mary said about a manufacturing stimulus policy, perhaps using Germany as an example. I mean, if the goal is to try to figure out how to get people in this country to have be able to benefit from these trade policies, are there things we could learn from other countries that might help some of these workers that have been hurt, whose jobs have been lost?
Absolutely. So what we're really talking about here is a possibly comprehensive industrial policy that allows the U.S. to look forward and invest in people in the jobs of tomorrow. That could be anything from solar power to wind power to healthcare to climate change adaption. And I completely agree that we need to help those people. But trying to preserve textile mills, which are really better left to the forces of the market, I think is going to be less productive than government helping it, working with business to think about the future.
Jared, we're almost up in a break. Any response to Mary's comment?
Yeah, I very much agree with both the caller and with Ann's response to the caller. There is a lot we could do to help boost our advanced manufacturing sector. The Obama administration has done some. I'm happy to talk about it. They've got these innovation hubs that are coming online. But the point is that if you look at Germany, about 20% of their workforce is in manufacturing. It's about half that for us. So, yeah, I do think there are things we could learn.
And that's Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was Vice President Joe Biden's chief economist and also an economic advisor to the vice president. Ann Harrison is with us. She's a professor of multinational management and professor of business economics and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, a member of the UN Committee for Development Policy. We are talking about trade and trade agreements. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and we can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ann Harrison and Jared Bernstein about trade and trade agreements, trade policy. We heard from Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Ted Cruz. Here's Hillary Clinton discussing some of her reservations about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, on the PBS NewsHour. This goes back to the fall.
Well, I have said from the very beginning that we had to have a trade agreement that would create good American jobs, raise wages, and advance our national security. And I still believe that's the high bar we have to meet. I have been trying to learn as much as I can about the agreement, but I'm worried. I'm worried about currency manipulation not being part of the agreement. We've lost American jobs to the manipulations that countries, particularly in Asia, have engaged in. I'm worried that the pharmaceutical companies may have gotten more benefits and patients and consumers fewer. I think that there are still a lot of unanswered questions, but for me, it really comes down to those three points that I made.
Let me get David from Flemington to join our conversation. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
My question is, historically, for the United States, is there a direct correlation, a causal relationship between protectionist policies and war?
An interesting way of putting the question. Let me see what Ann Harrison has to say, and perhaps even flipping that, trade policies and peace.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's certainly true in general. If you look at countries throughout the world, there's been some studies done by Philippe Martin at the University of Paris. Suggests that when countries tend to trade more with each other and presumably have less protection vis-a-vis each other, they're less likely to engage in conflict. So your intuition is right. For the U.S. in particular, trade embargoes tend to follow wars. So it tends to be the reverse. When we got in a war with the British or we got in a war, then we tend to stop trading with them. But trade tends to generate peace. One thing I should point out is that the U.S. had a very mistaken reaction after the 1929 stock market crash. We thought that the problem was trade. And so what we did is we erected very high tariff barriers, like 40-50%. And that actually exacerbated the problem and transmitted the world crisis to the rest of the world. In this recent crisis in 2008-2009, policymakers were very aware of this lesson, and they avoided this problem.
Jared, does it matter with trade whether we're trading with a wealthy country or a poor country? It's interesting we're having this conversation while President Obama, getting back from his trip to Cuba, trying to open up a different relationship with that country. But does it matter whether we're trading with Germany or whether we're trading with Bangladesh?
Oh, it matters tremendously for lots of reasons. First of all, one of the reasons I support expanded trade is because poor people in Bangladesh need a chance to improve their living standards, too. But when you're talking about low prices as a benefit from trade, you're talking about the results of typically trading with low-wage countries. And by the way, it's not just the statistics and the reality, but trade theory is very clear on this point. That when you engage in countries with low wage labor forces, that's going to have a negative impact on wages here, and that's the root of the Bivens work I talked about earlier. Just one point on this trade and war, because it's a great question.
Yes.
One thing that's kind of a head scratcher for me is if you believe that countries we trade, and I do, as Anne suggested, if you believe that the trade is a good way to kind of integrate countries and avoid conflict, I'm not really sure of the wisdom of trying to box China out the way we've been doing with the TPP. I mean, it's really been sold as a way to organize trade without China's input. And I'm not sure that's geopolitically smart.
Let me see what Stephen from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Stephen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I think that too much of the problem is being blamed upon trade or globalization or education. Earlier, Floyd Norris, who wrote for the New York Times business section, ran a series of articles about the amount of money being taken out of companies by way of stock buybacks and stock options in publicly traded companies, which wasn't allowed prior to 1980. And he pointed to the fact that that money was being taken out, and then you didn't have R&D or plan improvements, et cetera. And then they would take the company private. And I don't think that's really been looked upon as really a source of our problems, is that instead of investing for the future, you have an activist hedge fund or whatever, or senior management pull the money out. And in one way, stock price doesn't correlate to profits in any event.
Well, Stephen, it's a really interesting point. We could probably should do a whole hour on that. But let me see if Ann Harrison has any thoughts or Jared Bernstein. If we're talking about, I guess, who's been hurt and whether companies, whether it's globalization or whether it's something that Stephen has described. Do you have thoughts on that, Ann?
Well, let me just agree with Jared on this point and agree with a lot of the research, including stuff that I've done. It's true that some people are hurt, and it's true that they tend to be people with less education, people with fewer opportunities, people who are older in age. And I think we do need to do something about that as a country. So I think the candidates bringing that to our attention is a good thing. Now, what we can do about that, I mean, think about it. China has an investment rate of 50% of GDP. They're investing huge amounts in education, infrastructure.
Half of their GDP being
invested?
It's
incredible. So I think if we were to invest the way the Chinese do, the way a lot of Asia does in education, infrastructure, that would be the best thing we could do for our country's future.
Jared, what do you say back to Stephen's idea?
I think Stephen is talking about something very important, and it kind of dovetails with Anne, suggesting that there needs to be more internal investment versus kind of fooling around with innovative financial instruments and stock buybacks. That's gotten us nowhere in terms of productivity, growth, and jobs. However, I will say this. There's a bit of a squeezing the balloon problem. I know the research Stephen's talking about. If you were to block companies from doing stock buybacks, there's no guarantee that they would then sink that money into the kinds of investments that Ann and I want to see. They might go ahead and do a bunch of mergers or buy a bunch of derivatives. So I think this needs to be more of a much more deep public policy approach towards increasing investment.
Let me see what Simon. Stephen, thanks for the call. Let's see what Simon from Pottstown has to say. Hi, Simon. Go ahead. You're on the air. Simon, you're on the air.
Yeah, just a second. I'm sorry.
We're on the radio, Simon. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't have a Hi, everyone. Yeah, I own my brother and I. We own an innovative company that makes performance automotive parts for Lexus and Toyota and other motor vehicles. Actually, imported motor vehicles, and we ship parts all over the world. And we know how hard it is to, for first of all, to export automotive parts to Japan, Korea, or China is impossible. I mean, they have very high tariffs. They protect their industry. They won't let you import. So anybody can import parts here with almost no tariffs. Exporting parts overseas to those countries is impossible. Even to Canada, even our Canadian customers are taxed on parts that we send to them, that we ship to them. So the point is, I don't think the government should pick winners and losers like the professor suggested, that we should encourage the industries that are favored by the left today, solar power or whatever the favor of the month is, because that's proven to be unsuccessful. I think the government should not be in the business of picking winners and losers. The government should create a fair competitive environment in its trades policy.
Well, Simon,
and from that perspective, Trump has a point, right? Because anybody can import parts here, very hard to export.
Well, you raised some really interesting points, and just for equal time, even though you were directing it to Ann Harrison, let me give Jared a chance to respond to that as well. And the idea of what tariff wars and what Simon is saying is it's an unequal playing field.
Right. I mean, I think Simon has a point, and in fact, he sounds like he's in the midst of trying to deal with this in the real world. I would point out that we have trade agreements with most of the countries that he mentioned, including Canada and Korea. And, of course, those countries have been targeted at bringing down tariffs, and, in fact, the tariffs are already pretty low. What we're stuck with countries like that are something called non-tariff barriers, things that they do even after these trade agreements have been completed to block exporters like Simon. And the answer there is we need to do something individually. This doesn't need to be a free trade agreement. The U.S. needs to pass legislation against the manipulation of currency, is something Hillary Clinton mentioned, which is a very serious non-tariff barrier. And that would help.
The idea of individual agreements. Anne, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out to Simon that the TPP is actually designed specifically to try to open these markets to the auto industry, because they have recognized how difficult it is for you to export into Japan and Korea and Canada. So the auto industry is specifically targeted to try to open up those markets to make it a more level playing field. So hopefully it will work.
We have a Facebook comment from David. He says, I'm trying to understand how NAFTA costs the U.S. jobs, but in the Clinton years, jobs grew $23 million. Do you have an answer to that, Jared?
Not $23 million, $23 million jobs.
Yeah, $23 million. Jobs,
no, that's exactly my point. We spend way too much time and much too much divisive, fractious politics arguing about these trade agreements when there's so many moving parts. You can't possibly do, as by the way, advocates for these agreements say, oh, if you pass NAFTA, there's going to be tremendous job boom. And the opponents say, if you pass NAFTA, we're going to get killed. Neither side is anything like correct. And in fact, most of the actual modeling of these trade agreements assume balanced trade and full employment. So it's really irrelevant. What we need to focus on is the impact of trade, not trade agreements, and ways to level the playing field for us and for emerging economies. And unfortunately, when you have the kind of people that you've had as stakeholders at the meetings that derive these trade agreements, that hasn't been the case.
I'm looking at something that came from Marketplace. They did some research finding out where the public stands on some of these free trade agreements. What they found was almost half of respondents reported that they didn't know enough to say whether free trade agreements are good or bad for the U.S. economy. We invited the two of you here so that we could have some clarity. And obviously, we're getting some different points of view. And I'm also looking at you and Harrison. I mean, I think it's important to have points of view, obviously. But it's hard to come down and say this is good and this is bad, that it's kind of a mixed bag. Yes, you're nodding at me.
Well, I agree that there are winners and losers, but I agree that we need to help losers. But ultimately, I really do think that what's happening is there's a shift towards other parts of the economy, and we need to embrace that. We need to embrace the markets outside the United States, and that's a difficult message in an election year to convey, and so... Mm-hmm. Trade gets battered.
Let me get Trevor from Downingtown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Trevor. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
Two quick observations from my direct experience. In the 1980s, I was representing three different companies that sold semiconductor test equipment to the leading microchip manufacturers in this country, principally AT&T. And in Allentown and in Reading, AT&T employed thousands of hourly labor supervising automated electrical testing of semiconductors. Over a period of about 3 years, all of those jobs went to Taiwan. And it was clear to everybody in not only testing but in engineering, that the only reason those jobs went to Taiwan was because they were going to garner a minimal price reduction in terms of the direct labor for testing. But those semiconductors were the most advanced devices in the world at that time.
Well, you know what, Trevor?
They were being sold all over the world,
Trevor,
without any price.
Trevor, I got to jump in here only because we don't have time for your second point, and I'm looking at the computer here, and I'm going to give this to you, Jared Bernstein. He's saying, using that example, it was about short-term bottom-line profits. And, I mean, this was the 1980s. Is it better in 2016?
No, I mean, I think that the way advanced economies, especially capitalist ones, work is precisely like that. And, you know, that's the program we've signed up for, and it ain't going to change anytime soon. I think the example we just heard is an important one because it suggests it's not just textile workers who are losing jobs. It's higher-end workers here as well. And my point is that these kinds of trends are going to continue. And Ann and I might have a disagreement about whether we should try to do something about this through trade agreements. I don't think so. She apparently does. The point is that going forward, based on the politics, on the populism, I don't think that's going to happen. I just don't think we're going to see trade agreements in our near future. I happen to think that's fine because I think that the process has become really pretty dysfunctional. What we're going to then need, and I would enlist Ann and other smart people's help in this, is ways to figure out how to solve this problem that doesn't involve trade agreements. I've started to think about that and write about it. That, to me, is the way forward.
Well, we have to end on that note. Jared Bernstein, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And Harrison, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And she is the William H. Worster Professor of Multinational Management and Professor of Business Economics and Public Policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. We appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times. Clearly, a lot of people wanted to talk about trade and trade agreements and NAFTA and TPP. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.